I told Raj when he asked me to do this, I said, it really does sound like you want an ag engineer in here. He said, no, no, I want you. And I said, no, no, I think you want an ag engineer. And after he had my arm wrapped around my neck three times, I finally gave in. But I told him it would only be if I could get a couple ag engineers to help me put together the information I felt like needed to be presented for this. So Raj, and I have two individuals that I highly value and individuals that I've respected relative to this area, Dr. Slava Adamchuk at University of Nebraska, and then a colleague of mine, Dr. Ken Seddeth. And some of the things I've worked very closely with both of these individuals on. And so I really do acknowledge them. And this idea of using soil sensors really to kind of get at our understanding of the soil, the condition of the soil, what we need to do management-wise is obviously something we've thought about for some time. And so a little bit of where I'm going to try to give us a little bit of a sense where we're at maybe ask a few or make a few points at the end to kind of help us consider issues that are associated with this. The expense of soil sampling, and I'm putting those dollar signs for my S's up there, that's a challenge because as we consider, you know, humans as the sensors of soils in a manual process where we're collecting, boxing, extracting, deciding what to do and then applying, there's just a lot of steps there. And so the whole thing just gets laborious. Laborious meaning it's labor intensive and it's and so we there's that side, or that issue, the cost of, involved with that. That wedded with the second issue of, and that is the variability. And I think Bob did a great job of kind of bringing that to light relative to his presentation. And my daughters claim that I'm an exaggerator. Okay. So, I'm going to use an example that I've used in several places, and it's maybe an exaggeration, but it kind of helps us to get our hands wrapped around the difficulty here. How do we get this representative sample? And in order to do this, I have this analogy that I use, and that is, you've got this volume of soil out there for a field. Sometimes we don't really get a handle on how much soil there is for a field. And so I have this 40-acre field. And let's relate this 40-acre field to something else we think of in terms of a survey. Well, the survey that I'm thinking of here is let's take a Gallup poll, where they usually take 1,000 voters out of the U.S. and they survey those 1,000. They decide who's going to win the election based upon those 1,000 voters. Well, that survey is 500 times more of the population than a farmer taking 10 soil subsamples to represent the soil volume of a 40-acre field, okay? 500 times more. Now, I know there's a lot of things relative to the spatial correlation and of what you have in a field. And if it's a no-till, then maybe we're talking about the same kind of problem here. So let's flip it around. So what does that mean? If we're going to take these numbers, this 10 samples here, and the 40-acre field, and let's say we're going to use that for the Gallup poll survey, just to kind of help you to appreciate this now, that means a person doing a Gallup poll survey would go out and they would take two likely voters, and from those two likely voters, they would decide who's going to win the election. Okay, when we're talking about how much soil we have out there, that's helps to put in perspective what we're trying to accomplish. And then we're only talking about the top 6 to 8 inches of soil. If we talk about the whole root zone, then the Gallup poll is 3,000 times more thorough in terms of evaluating than what we're doing in that surface part of the soil. So this is a challenge. That brings it to bear. Here we have an efficiency issue. We're trying to create something that's cost effective and also being able to do it in a very effective way, that heterogeneous soil for the management decisions. And that's what we're about. So trying to figure out how we do that. How can we do better? Not that soil sampling has not been good and has got us a long way, but there's certainly opportunity for growth or improvement. So then what have we learned? Well, we actually started learning back in the 1920s that variability was an issue. This is always fun to put up here, and that work there in Illinois, we didn't realize how kind of important that was, kind of in concept and getting it out there, but the whole idea of some sampling and zoning and kind of representing that variability, we felt like that was important. At least these folks there in Illinois did. And I don't think they realized how significant of a pioneering step that they were making by putting that out there. Well, then we got to the 80s and the 90s, and we had GPS technologies. And all of a sudden, we decided, hey, we can do this, and we can do this more cost-effectively. So let's take that soil sampling, go out there and do grid samples, and then we can do our maps, and we can do what we need to do. Well, we did that, and then guess what? We learned a lot of things, and the three things that I think we learned. One, the assessment of the soil variability is one of the most important steps in site-specific field management. The conventional means to obtain soil variability data are, sometimes at least, incapable of accurately identifying spatial inconsistency within a given landscape at an economically feasible cost. Particularly if you're talking about a minimum till or a no-till situation where that variability is so pronounced, how good is your soil sample unless you're just sampling, taking lots and lots of samples, and then the cost goes right out. So then from that logical conclusion is there's a need to develop proximity sensors to map soil attributes on the go, if at all possible. And certainly the ag engineers, they're the ones that are tasked or have the skill and the ability and the desire to do that. And so that's why I suggested at the beginning that it would be good to have them delivering this message. And so from here, we're going to kind of consider some of those things. This is just showing that this is where we were in the 80s here, trying to do it this way. But then when we started looking within those hectare cells, and it's pretty tough to see that. I wish we had about three times larger screen to be able to see that, but there's a lot of variability within those scales, and this is something that's done with more of a on-the-go type of a sensing. So there's a lot of variability there that we're missing when we try to go to cells there. So essentially what we really want to do is we want to kind of collapse this, I don't know if this makes sense, but collapse the soil sample to fertilizer application gap. We're going to bring that together and bring it all together and do it with something else. And the example I illustrated this is actually a picture that the Nebraska folks shared with me, because this is a cool looking picture. But here they're using their canopy sensors to evaluate the corn, and there's a decision made on. And then there's a variable rate application, and probably somebody who's in extension safety or OSHA person probably wouldn't like to see these guys standing around on the top there. But that's why I used their picture instead of mine, because I had my guys on there too, but I figured I'd get them in trouble instead. Anyway, and some would even say this isn't a soil sensor. Well, it is, because you're just using your plant as the indicator of the soil condition in this case to try to indicate what you need to do for nitrogen management, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about this one at the end. Sensor use approaches, and this is one that Slava gave to me, several different approaches. Certainly, you take your sensor out there, you do a map-based approach with your GPS system, and you collect the data, you create the map, and then in some second step, you go out there and do your application. The other in the real-time application, where your sensor is giving your information, a decision is being made, and you're doing the application. So the previous example with the Nebraska picture was kind of like this. And then there's even a third one, and that's kind of an integration of the two, and that is where you may have a map-based information as well as some kind of a sensor information, and you're kind of taking multiple sensed information to make a decision, or the idea of fusing sensor information to come up with a better decision. And that's probably where we're seeing more and more advancement, is in the idea of fusing different types of information together to help us have a better understanding of what we need to do. Now, these on-the-go sensor types, and this is another one from Slava, and I really like this. There's electrical and electromagnetic, the optical and radiometric, mechanical, acoustic, there's pneumatic, and there's electrochemical. And that sounds really technical, and that sounds really like an ag engineer, but, we can relate these things to the humans, because these are just taking the human sensor and breaking that up and basically looking at that and using terms that sometimes we don't necessarily use. But so the human is great, but the human isn't able to store data and make maps on the go like what we need to have. So the whole idea then is to take these different properties or different sensing types of information. And this particular one that Slava put together kind of breaks those those different types of sensor information, some of the different sensors that are out there right now, and then some of the properties that are available. And I know there's a lot more up there than what you can see. And this particular slide has been around for a couple of years. If this is really of interest to you, you just need to go to his website and look at this and kind of stare at it. And you can really get a lot of education just by looking at this particular slide and giving a better understanding of these different technologies that are out there and how potentially they're being used. What I want to do then is just I want to take four different examples. They're ones that we've used and find that there's, you know, some success, some quite a bit of success with, and kind of illustrate that from here. Because we are making some progress. So the ag engineers working with agronomists, soil scientists are making progress here. We'd like to see more, but it come more quickly, but I think, there's some big challenges still we're working through as a part of making these sensors work. First example is this electrochemical sensors, and these can be a combination of ion selective electrodes or ISFETs, which are ion selective field effect transistors. And how do you get measurements with these things? Well, there's the traditional way of doing this is kind of through soil solution measurement, and this is really what we do in the lab. These can be done, and you can get a soil solution extract, and you can use those sensors to be able to come up with an understanding of the amount that you have in your solution. But to take this to the field, you've got to at least get an agitated soil measurement or a direct soil measurement, and that's where the challenge is. And so the work has been done to take these, and there's been some pretty good success, at least with these particular elements shown there, a few others too, but those are what I'm going to use as an example. Now, the first step in doing that is first the automated soil testing, and Slava did his work and his PhD at Purdue did a pretty good job of kind of working through the bugs in terms of how do you get a sample and get it up against an electrode and be able to measure that. And do that in a way, and then get it emptied out, and conceptually it sounds good. Take that lab and take it to the field. Amazing engineering kind of think through that you got to go through to be able to make that happen. This is actually the picture he had. From his work there at Purdue. This is kind of what he had at that point. Went to Nebraska, and he's worked with Veris, and this same thing is really what he worked with them as a part of helping to ruggedize and develop this a little bit further. In this case, though, they have both the electrical conductivity and the soil pH sensing on the go. So this is a good example of fusing multiple sensors to try to get different types of information that may be of value as part of the decisions made. And certainly the map on the left allows us to see much greater resolution in variability than a map that's generated by grid soil sampling. And so this is powerful. This is extremely powerful. And I think it's this way we're going to be going in the future. The whole idea of being able to, particularly in a situation where you have variability that's changing on a very short range, sensors are going to have to be something that we consider as a part of making, getting the understanding of that. Where's my time? Okay. On-the-go nutrient analysis system. This is work with Hak-Jin Kim, Dr. Hummel, Dr. Suddeth. They're in my research group. Hak-Jin was from Korea. He did some work with ion-selective electrodes and kind of the steps of nutrient extraction to solution and analysis. With this extraction, his goal was to be able to come up with a universal extraction. Problem is, many of the extractions that we have, if you want to look at NPK at the same time, you end up using chemicals that have those in it, and so you can't hardly do that. And so he did a fairly thorough survey of some of the different extractants that have been used over time, and came up with one that seemed to work pretty good, and then developed some electrodes, some ion-selective electrodes that would be able to look at that. And we'll look at a little bit of the results here. The solution is the Kelowna solution, which is a acetic acid, ammonium fluoride solution. Obviously, you're not going to be able to look at ammonium, but you can look at nitrate, okay? And with that solution, we could look at nitrate, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And so here we're looking at the sensitivity and the range of what we would normally see in soils and we can see that indeed the sensor gives you that, the extracting solution, that's Kelowna, allows you to get that type of, course, that nitrate is soluble, so you would hope you'd be able to get it. How about the others, the potassium and the phosphorus? That's where you're really going at more of an extraction solution. Well, this is more the standard procedure for getting that out. This is using that Kelowna and that ion selective electrode for again, this one's potassium and this one's phosphorus. And you can see we're not getting as much out. It's about 60% here and about 55% here, I believe it is. Maybe not even quite that much, maybe more like 40%. And so you're not getting as much out, but there's still a pretty strong relationship there to be able to take that kind of a solution extract to be able to look at those three elements at the same time. And I cut out a few slides to show the apparatus that is developed, but the idea is multiple, extract, fairly quickly extract it, get it over your selector, your ion selective electrode, boom, it's back out and you're resampling again. Next example I wanted to talk about is using SoilEC to assess soil fertility conditions. And I've used this multiple times. Some of you have probably seen this before, and I think it's a great one, and nobody seems to think so, but oh well, I'll keep cheering. Unlike the previous presentation that talked about EC for sampling or zone sampling, this is using EC to actually better understand fertility, particularly subsoil fertility. And we kind of bumped into this in our clay pan soils in Missouri. EC, we found early on, was a real good indicator of topsoil depth. And where you had high EC is where you had very thin topsoil, and low EC is where you had a really deep topsoil. And that's it's a characteristic of our fields that's just almost with every field. Well, then we started looking at the subsoil fertility, and we found that if we look at the whole profile of fertility, and that topsoil depth relationship, like we would look at with EC, man, there's an extremely good relationship there. What does that mean? Well, you could use EC then to help you give a good understanding of the subsoil fertility. And indeed, we showed this to a couple farmers. One, Bruce Wilson near Mexico, Missouri, took that. He took EC map of his field. He classed it into three zones. And then he just looked at the subsoil fertility on those zones in the 12 to 36, and looked at the amount of the available, in a pounds per acre basis, but where he had low EC, which is a higher topsoil, is where he has lowest subsoil fertility, and it goes up from there. And so he's actually using soil EC now to direct his phosphorus and potassium, because he thinks this is the area where he needs to put his fertilizer dollars, because his subsoil is giving him much more than in these areas where EC is higher. Really good example of using, again, sensors to be able to figure out what you do. Soil organic matter, Dr. Suddeth actually did his work, Ken did, on reflectance measurements of soil organic matter, found some very good relationships. This was back in the early 80s, kind of set it aside, and it's really gained got renewed interest of recent. There's one of the current type sensors where you can do visible to NIR sensing. A former graduate student actually used this as a part of being able to look at profile. So this is the depth, but this is the full range and the reflectance characteristics with depth over that full range of visible to near infrared. And you can see there's tremendous information as a result of this kind of a sensing. And then essentially you can take different depths of that and see that there is a signature difference in reflectance by depth. Well, what do those relate to? There's got to be some properties. Well, soil clay is a big one. Soil water is a big one. But even something like soil organic matter, soil carbon is very big. And so he took this and developed some calibrations between observed and estimated using those calibrations and come up with some very good relationships that allow you to not only basically, it becomes a signature in the soil. So this is like the soil surface. This is soil organic carbon. And then we can, with that device, basically show the relationship over the whole profile of how soil organic matter changes using that sensor information. Once you get a calibration, you can do a lot of profiles very quickly. This is actually clay content. So two variables that we're interested in. And you can see that there's very good fitting with those curves. Veris has taken and done this Their P4000 has a visible near-infrared sensor on it, but it also has EC and force probes. So they've kind of commercialized this whole idea with this particular device. I think you still have it out there, Eric, don't you? Okay. And in addition to that, they're a visible NIR spectrophotometer shank that's pulled through the soil that basically has the same kind of readings, but you're just looking at, you know, that near surface or one depth. How much time?
30 seconds.
30 seconds? Yes. I kept my last one. Not unlike this one, Holland Scientific has got a sensor they're working at, but they're not doing the full spectrum. They're actually looking at just a couple of wavelengths and trying to look at that relationship with soil. So there's other people that are also doing that and seeing that they can get really good relationships of soil organic matter with this reflectance type sensing. And my final one, and I've got 15 seconds now to share it. I'm going to go through that really quickly, I guess, and really get to the point on that. And that is that there's, like on this field, there's tremendous variability in soil nitrogen. We really do feel like and have had quite a good success in Missouri being able to get farmers to look at this whole idea. Here in this field here, on this end of the field, we didn't need additional nitrogen. On this end of the field, we needed 200 kilograms of per hectare of nitrogen over back over on this side of the field. You can kind of see that with the aerial photo, that work has been combined. There's about 16 fields we've put together, and there's a paper that will be coming out early next year with regards to that. The calibration or the recommendation that we have right now is this line here, and so it fits pretty well with the 16 fields that we've been collecting over these from 2004-2007. Do I have time to go through these?
Yes, you're the last presenter. So
okay.
You are the incoming
president. This is my first perk. Technology is expanding. It's continuing to expand. Many sensor approaches are past development. Some are in the commercialization stage, and we should be encouraged by them. We should embrace them. We should be testing them. We should be seeing. If anything, this continues to be an area where there should be great cooperation between engineers like Slava and agronomists and soil scientists. I mean, this is a really good example of how people should be working together across disciplines. More sensors mean more data. So what does that mean? We're going to have some fairly sophisticated interpretation software in order to make that happen. Consultants will be needed to understand it, particularly as we start fusing different sensor information together. I don't understand it very well myself. I'm learning. I'm growing. I'm trying to understand these things. And so I'm glad that the ag engineers are patient. Use of technology will cost dollars. Obviously, as any other technologies, we'll see those costs come down. As time goes on, sensor fusion provides the ability to separate various agronomic factors, and that's kind of a critical thing. Site-specific sensor calibration and validation are essential steps of the mapping process. With some sensors, it's required almost on a field-by-field basis, or at least on a farm or region basis. So there are still going to be some upfront costs to kind of go along with that. Laboratory soil analysis remains the required supplemental practice, at least. We're babes here in this area. We're still crawling on the floor, but I think that there's reason to have hope. Thanks.
The floor is now open for discussion. We have 20 minutes of scheduled time. We could consume all of that. We don't have to. Questions at this time for Noel? Okay, Jared.
Yes. So what was on when you showed the reflectance picking up on clay and organic matter?
Uh-huh.
Was those, I couldn't see, the screen's too small, you pointed out for the presentation. Were those indices that you were using to predict those, like soil acidity or something like that, or was it red, green, or
No, essentially, again, you have that full range from about 400 up to 2,500 of information, and using partial least squares regression, you're picking out those bands that give you the most information, developing a calibration, And then with that calibration, going back and applying it and being able to give that, essentially giving that profile signature of what those properties were. It is hyperspectral data, yes.
I'm interested in knowing what kind of work has been done to verify the reliability of the specific ion electrodes. And I kind of draw my question of having worked with those things in the laboratory and having a lot of difficulty getting them to be stable and reproducible from time to time.
How much work has been done in terms of interference and stability and durability, and that is that the kind of question?
Same answer
twice. there's quite a bit of work that's been done in other fields, particularly the medical field, for kind of trying to figure out those membranes. Now, those membranes sometimes are not very easy to keep to ruggedize, to keep them. I mean, you take them to a field, it's a whole different story. The ISFETs probably have more promise there. Dr. Stuart Burrell at Iowa State started with us doing quite a bit of work on there and has continued to do some work in there. I don't have a good answer for you. I know it's progressing. I don't know if, actually, I'm sure there's several others in the room that probably could help answer your question in terms of the state of where we're at today. We're making progress. I don't know as if there's anything that's other than like the pH, like what Veris has with theirs currently. I'm not sure if those others have been put onto the platform and taken to the field. Eric,
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's an engineering problem, you know. Let them figure it out, and we'll just play with the toys. You know, we'll make them, we'll test them out. So. I don't know. I remember seeing that kind of an issue too. Part of it is just being able to how you gingerly take that sample and get it up against the electrode and get it washed off without there being a lot of movement of that material as it is against it. I think that the design that Adam Chuck come up with in terms of just kind of lifts it and brings it up against it and then it just, you know, it washes it off, drops it back off. Works pretty good. I don't know. Can you tell us at this point how long that electrode will last?
The glass electrode really did have an abrasion problem, but Slava has actually helped source an antimony, develop an antimony metalloid electrode.
Yeah.
It really is the best and had a major improvement. We've gone completely away from glass, 100% to the antimony.
How many acres could you do? And cost replacement of those electrodes, I wouldn't know that, but how much?
About 150.
Okay.
So it's about a 10 cent to 30 cent per acre.
Good question.
I'll leave so you can answer all the questions.
No, like I said.
I have a comment or question. Is it fair to say that we may be far from accuracy in terms of using these sensors, but in terms of pattern in the field, these sensors are up to speed that they can, when you're done sensing for a 100-acre field, you have a pattern that is pretty reliable, and I think that's what your question was, but we may be far from accuracy.
Right. You give up control, like that you get in the lab, and so you're maybe, you have a little bit more noise if you took that very sample and took it into the lab, you know. So you have more noise, but not as much accuracy, but you more than compensate for that as a result of the number of samples that you get and dealing with that variability that you have spatially.
Okay. Yes.
electrode, we still are looking in a snapshot. I mean, the electrode, when it comes to potassium, you know, it doesn't really tell you the whole story, because it will look still at just a fraction of what is available to the plant. You know, just the salt solution, when it comes to potassium, the salt solution is just a fraction.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the whole purpose of an extracting solution is that it is calibrated to a response that you kind of know about, so that you have meaning to the extraction, the solution measurement that you have. And so,
we definitely do.
I have a question for Bob Miller. Okay. Do you have any idea on the practices? Was there any difference in variability from fields where there was variable rate potassium applied compared to blanket? Do you have that type of
thing? No, all the fields, I asked the growers for the samplers and they pulled for fields where they did blanket applications, be it band or broadband.
Okay, I'll take that as questions for Bob Miller right now at the moment. He talked about the number of cores and the number of samples required in order to capture variability that's out there. Okay, two questions. Go ahead.
I have a question for
Miller. Come on over, Rob.
Just management strategy for sampling, soil sampling, rate-based system, because to minimize the variability, because in this case, we have to capture both bed and harvest.
Did you
no,
understand?
I did not capture that.
Could you repeat that for me? Because I didn't quite fully understand it.
What will be the best strategy for soil sampling in case of a rate-based system to minimize the variability?
What should we do to minimize the variability?
Yeah, in the rate-based system.
The raised bed system.
On the raised bed system.
Because it has both raised bed and farm, so how we can capture
both? I really don't know what to say to that other than the fact that in the tilled fields we had, and there was some that had ridge, what was called ridge till, where they till it up, the variability was less there than it was in the planer or no-till systems. So I'm sorry I didn't quite fully understand. Maybe we'll talk afterwards. Yeah, Paul? I already had that feeling. Exactly. Well, the thing that I found in this data set that really enlightened me was, you look at, we took one of these grid points, and we didn't do 12 cores, we did 24. And the point I'm saying is, you can keep, until you sample the entire block of soil, you can't arrive at the number, because that's what the variability is. If you notice those RSDs, they go down and they plateau out. They don't change. The uncertainty is this wide in those samples. Now, what I say in talking about the 21st century here is, I said try to get it to it at the end of my talk, and I got cut on my own time. But we've got to come up with a new sampling technique. And I'll just tell you what my thoughts are on this. I've worked with the samplers in the field. We've had lots of coffee and donut sessions when in all this rainy weather sits in the Midwest and talk about this subject. I think, and I'm going to get called a heretic now, so I'm getting my shield up for the arrows, we got to do away with a 0 to 6 inch or a 0 to 8 inch core. I think we need to do a 1 to 8 inch or a 1 to 6 inch and throw away the top 1 inch because that's where the variability is. We've got some preliminary data. The variability on the no-till is coming in the top inch or the top 2 inches. We looked, and we've only got two locations, but there's some more lab data in the lab right now. It said that on the whole 6-inch core, for 12 cores on this one site, the RSE for phosphorus was like 34%. We took off the top inch and reanalyzed the data set, and the variability in the next 1 to 6 fell to 11%.
But Bob, the question, as I think I can pick up on your question, is if I'm a corn plant and the nutrients, and you have some stratus there, and nutrients are lying there, you're saying toss it away because you want to minimize variability in your sampling. That's not my objective. Objective is to get a good hold on what kind of nutrients, you know.
Yeah, but go back to Barbara Mengel's work when they looked at roots and how they develop in the profile. Very small percentage of the corn roots are in the top 1 inch.
And corn, I mean, corn is one crop, right? But sampling is needed for...
Oh, absolutely. Now, you change crops, now we change ball games. I mean, if we're going to talk lettuce in California, then obviously we're going to be back in that ballpark. But I'm saying is, if you go look at the no-till system for corn and probably soybeans, I don't know that, function the sampling on where the roots are. Oh, there's action.
You drop down deeper in the profile, you get less and less aeration and less and less microbial activity.
I'm welcoming the arrows. The phosphorus and the potassium, though, if you look at, like, corn, okay, and you look at V4, V14, that's when corn's pumping all the K out of the soil. Once you get to fizzle or anthesis, not much is happening with K. Those roots are basically running from 2 to 12 inches.
Okay, there's a question there.
And we'll
okay, I'll jump in. You may not be wrong agronomically, Bob, so I actually agree with you on that. There could be merit to that. The other side is the more we find out about the environmental impacts, especially possible runoff, that type of thing, you may be setting yourself up for two separate samples. You don't throw the top in.
Don't disagree. But, you know, I have the, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't share it. We got rushed through it at the end of the slides. Again, my fault on that. We had a field in Illinois that not only did we do the 12 cores, we did depth because I'm interested in stratification. Now, I got to challenge you guys in the audience. If in this field, the Bray phosphorus 8 inches was 68, but the top 1 inch was 144. Now, what does that tell you about P runoff on that field? Well, I scare the NRCS people because I tell them it needs a plow. Nat.
We have time for two more questions. And before we run out of time, I've been instructed by our division chair to announce that we have our S4 and S8 business meeting at 4:30. So I should push everybody out of here by 4:30, which leaves us 2 minutes to go to the next question.
Bob, I want to piggyback a little bit upon what Paul asked.
Yeah, but if our uncertainty is so bad that we don't capture, I mean, you know, farmers, I see these all the time. You'll give them a number, 35 Bray. They think it's between 34.5 and 35.5. And exactly. Well, sometimes they think it's 35.0001. But my point is that you got to have capture in what the variability is to say, hey, a 20 is different than a 35.
Okay, last comment.
Yes, and not that I want to poke in matters, but if you just look at spatial variability, and you know, like we've been collecting soil samples every 3 weeks for the last 2 years, fallow ground, areas very small. there is a lot of seasonality.
So there's temporal, yeah.
Temporal variability can be even higher. And that's a bigger issue because our consultants, they take samples, although we tell them, try to take samples at the same time of the year. In reality, they take samples when they can. It can be October or it can be April.
We targeted ours, this whole study, we targeted fall sampling only because that's when the guys were doing it, and that's when they're generating their numbers for their maps. So, okay,